You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to an author debriefing from the International Spy Museum. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Here at the Spy Museum, we get the world's most interesting authors, including journalists, scholars, former spies and intelligence officers, coming in to answer questions about their latest works dealing with espionage, intelligence, and other national security issues. Please join me in listening to another of our selected author debriefings. So I'd like to welcome back all those who have been tuning into SpyCast in the past, and welcome anyone who is listening for the first time. If you are, please take a second to check out what we've done in earlier podcasts. I think you'll really enjoy it. One part of my job as historian and curator of the International Spy Museum is hosting this podcast, but a fairly significant part of my job is also talking to the public about popular representations of intelligence that are shown by Hollywood. Sometimes these are movies, like James Bond, Jason Bourne, and the Mission Impossible series. Sometimes the result of the many TV shows that are on today or have been on in the recent past, such as Homeland, 24, Alias, The Americans, etc. It goes on and on. The reason I bring this up is that Hollywood has given us yet another version of intelligence history. This time it is Steven Spielberg's Bridge of Spies, in which Tom Hanks plays attorney James Donovan. Bridge of Spies plot surrounds the spy trade of American Francis Gary Powers for Soviet spy Rudolf Abel. Our guest today will help us negotiate reality versus fiction. Vin Arthy is a writer, researcher, and speaker who has a very unique perspective on the Abel case. He is also the author of the new book, Abel, The True Story of the Spy They Traded for Gary Powers. Vin, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at the International Spy Museum.
It's a delight to be here.
So whenever I have an author here for SpyCast, I ask two questions. And the first focuses on inspiration. And all of our authors are fantastic. We wouldn't have them here otherwise. But you really have a unique perspective and a unique inspiration on what led you to write a book about Rudolf Abel. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I first came across this story when I was 11 years old. That was the year 1956 when my parents got the first television set that ever came into our house. I was 11 years old. Kids' programs were beneath me, except perhaps for The Lone Ranger. And I wanted to stay up for early and late evening comedy, but I wasn't allowed to. I had to do my homework quite a bit. But so what I saw mainly was news. And in 1957, on the news, I saw this guy with a black straw hat with a white band, a Soviet spy who'd been captured in New York and was going to trial. Wow, you know, this was a real story. I was fascinated by it. They've got illegal spies around. When I was a teenager, there was then the spy swap. I'd known about the U-2 aircraft being shot down. And I must say, I was born and brought up in East Anglia, which was very significant during that stage of the Cold War. A great number of United States Air Force bases flying fighters to the Soviet border on a regular basis. We knew that. And then, after the U-2 was shot down, then there was the exchange. So there he was again, this guy going back. Cut to a few more years. I'm working in television production. I'm working in the northeast of England. And we do a series called Stranger Than Fiction. It's regional television where regional stories, which folks are stranger than fiction, come up. There was the stage hypnotist who swindled his mother out of thousands of pounds. There was the member of parliament who was a complete crook. There was the bank clerk who foretold the robbery of his own bank. And this story, the guy the world knows as Rudolf Ivanovich Abel was born in Newcastle upon Tyne in 1903. His real name was William Fisher, and that was it. Was this story was discovered by a professor, or then just a young researcher, and he'd read a book in Russian, and this book said, "The spy the world knows as Abel is really William Fisher. He was born on this date, at this address." And the historian, what did he do? He went to the registrar of births, marriages, and deaths, checked it out, and got the birth certificate. So that was the third stage. The hair standing up on the back of my neck now, because I suddenly thought, it's my story. I've got to write it. Right. And then I got on a roll. Things happened. People started talking to me. I got anonymous telephone messages. One giving me the Moscow telephone number of Evelyn, William Fisher, Abel's only daughter. So that's how it started.
Right. Well, it seems like something you can't pass up, right? I mean, it's just being force-fed. I mean, it's growing up and finding out a neighbor was one of the most world-famous spies, yeah. And then all of a sudden you have the phone number of his daughter. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you talk about, both in the book and in some of the interviews that you've given, is the idea that people were kind of showing you, when you got stuck on something, people were kind of guiding you towards open doors and open avenues to help you continue this research. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Well, that is very interesting. There's lots there. It's great talking about this in a spy museum because my friends say, you got on a roll. One of my thoughts was, who's controlling me in all this? Because I was getting American sources, and they were speaking to me, some of them anonymous. For example, someone sent me the CIA translation into English of Kirill Henkin's book, the book in Russian, that my friend had got the details of the birth certificate. That came anonymously. The telephone number for Evelyn Fisher came anonymously.
And by anonymously, you mean like slipped under your door?
The text of the Henkin book came by ordinary mail. The telephone number came in a telephone call. Is that Vin Arthi? Yes. You've been after Evelyn Fisher's telephone number? Yes. Have you got a pencil and paper there? Yes. This is it. Read it back to me. I read it back. Thank you very much. Click.
I mean, it's its own spy movie in itself, yeah.
It is.
One thing, the reason that I was very excited to have you on here is maybe there, outside of Abel's family, there are very few people that know him better. I know you didn't have sit-down conversations with him, but you really lived his life for as many, many years, because we talked about the idea of going back to the 1950s in this case. So I want to talk a little bit about who Fisher, let's use Abel Fisher with it interchangeably, was as a person, because he comes across to me by reading your book as a true believer in communism, but at the same time, as British as they come.
Thank you. Yeah. That's exactly what I wanted to show. He was a 100% committed ideological communist. You know, that, no question about that. But he was... He was an individual. He was hugely intelligent. He was cultured. And someone once said, if your biography is good, or if your history is good, you read, and then you meet the person. And I found that happening. He was a genuine man. He believed in what he believed in. He was a kind man. He had family problems, like we all have. He had a loving family. He loved music, he loved reading. I found all this. I found out a lot from his daughter. And let me tell you a couple of things she said. I once asked her about, when I visited in Moscow, she said something. She said, Vin, all this corruption there is now in this country, she said, it hasn't just happened. She said, communism was corrupt. It was corrupt. It's endemic. And then she said, and English was the language of their home. Fisher had got German blood, Russian blood, and probably Russian Jewish blood, almost certainly Russian Jewish blood. He spoke, his mother's language was Russian, his father, an ethnic German, his language was German. His Fischer's native language was English. He went to school where he learned French and some Latin, so he was bilingual. But English was the language of their home, and it was a sort of haven, a sort of sanctuary. I was talking to Evelyn about this. She said, Vin, she said, languages are very much like the people who speak them. I said, what do you mean? So she said, German is a very disciplined language. She said, English is a very flexible language. Russian is an anarchic language. And I once asked about Gorbachev as well, you see, because really the Gorbachev-Reagan conversations ended the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And I said to her, what did you make of Mr. Gorbachev, Evelyn? And she said, I heard Mr. Gorbachev make many long speeches, but I never heard him say anything.
Well, he's not the only one that falls into that trap. That's a politician for you in many cases. Something that comes across in your book and is that perhaps Abel Fischer didn't really regard Russians very highly. And I thought that was very interesting to see.
It is. It's very, very... this is complex. He was not Russian. And, of course, as you know so well in spying, you never know the whole story. Mm-hmm. And the whole story never ends. You're always looking and you're always finding out. He joined the Soviet security services because he got married. His new sister-in-law suggested with his skills that would be a good job for him. What do you do when you get married? You've got to keep your wife in the manner to which she's become accustomed. Mm-hmm. So you get a job, you know, which is what he did. One of the things you might have picked up is that, in Russian culture, certainly in Soviet culture, but now, the writing of the resume, the biography for every job you go for. And in those days, making sure that you were from a worker's family, that was so important. And when he joined the Red Army, where he trained as a radio operator, which is a huge and important part of his work, he filled in this form, and one of the sergeants had written in the margin, illiterate in Russian. And he was absolutely furious. Evelyn talked about, she said, he would tease me in the family about Russian. He said, you know, why do we have to use masculine and feminine for nouns? It's a nonsense. Mm-hmm. And on his deathbed, he said, his last words to his daughter, and probably his last words ever, were, remember, we're Germans. Mm. And I asked her, I said, did he say it in German or English? And she laughed, and she said, he said it in English.
I think there's really some really fascinating contradictions about Fischer. One of the ones that jumps out to me from the Spy Museum is the idea that perhaps he wasn't a particularly good spy. But at the same time, he was knee-deep in so many of the famous spy cases of the 20th century, and he's found himself around a lot of the important spy and espionage cases. But perhaps he himself wasn't instrumental in pulling off a lot of these cases.
Well, that is an interesting, a very interesting and very important point. But then... And here in this museum, you know better than others. What is a spy's job? A spy's job is to do the job that he is required to do, which might be to seduce women to get stories from their bosses. It might be to find out particular military and weaponry details. I think in Fischer's case, he had a number of jobs in his spying career. His Englishness was important. His first job was in Oslo in Norway because he had an English passport, a British passport. So his family had used their British passports to go from the United Kingdom to the Soviet Union in 1921. And, of course, his passport was open for a number of years. He had to renew it, so he went to the British Embassy in Moscow in the 1930s, told them a story and got his passport renewed, which enabled him first to go and spy for the Soviet Union in Oslo, where his job was setting up radio transmitters and receivers, and then to go to London in the United Kingdom with a similar job, setting up radio receivers and transmitters. Then in the war, his radio operation was important. He ran deception games with the Red Army against the Nazis. After the war, things begin to change. They didn't know what to do with him. So there was a crisis, a number of crises in KGB, I think. All of this stuff is classified. You never get it. So you have to, what is it, hunch intelligence. You have to work it out, you know. And what is intelligence? Intelligence is information on which you can act. But it is not evidence that will stand up to cross-examination in a court of law. So this is piecing it together. I think there was a problem in Moscow, and they didn't quite know what to do with Fischer. They knew he was reliable. Quite boring, and we've got a problem in the United States. They knew about Venona. They knew that the West, the Americans, had been reading some of their signals, but they didn't know which ones. Mm-hmm. After the Second World War, and really before the 1950s, the spy rings over there had been decimated in some way, or had been dead for some years. They needed someone to sort these things out. So he goes over there, goes over here, comes here, and he's sorting out trouble.
Right.
He's getting the Cohens out. He's tearing his hair out when the Rosenbergs are found guilty and executed. That really hit the Soviets very, very hard. That's something they didn't think would happen over here. And I think this is very significant, Stalin's death, Beria is head of KGB, right, is arrested, tried, and executed within hours. And the story is that Marshal Zhukov actually shot Beria in the Lubyanka cellars.
Couldn't have happened to a more deserving person.
Absolutely right. But when you look at that period, then everything's in chaos.
Right.
Who do they trust? So you've got this guy Abel, or you've got this guy Fischer, with the code name Mark, using the alias Emil Goldfuss. So you've got this guy in New York. What are his orders? What's he got to do? So really, he's got to keep the ship on the road. He's got to keep the show on the road. So if you look at that period, this is what he's doing. He's receiving messages. He's paying people. Why is he in New York? Not Washington? Not Los Angeles? Not San Francisco? I think it's because the United Nations is here. So he can get messages to agents from all over the world.
Right.
And he can pay agents from all over the world in New York. So he's doing this. He's receiving his radio messages. He's transmitting stuff. He's paying people. He's doing a boring administrative job. I think he's a great guy. Intelligent, intellectual, lots of skills. They should have had him back in Moscow, training the next generation. But, you know, life isn't like that.
Right.
So my opinion is, he wasn't the master spy. He was just an ordinary Joe doing his job.
And very famously, of course, passing messages and concealment devices like hollowed out nickels, which will eventually come back to haunt him in later years. For those of you out there who don't know this story, Vin, can you kind of lay down the hollow nickel story and how Abel eventually gets rolled up by American law enforcement?
Yeah, now this is significant. A young lad called Jimmy Bozart, who's a newsboy in New York, I think 13, 14 years old, he's going around collecting the newspaper money at the end of the week, got a pocket full of coins. As he was going home, a coin drops onto the paving stones, breaks open, and there's a tiny piece of microfilm inside it. He tells his girlfriend. His girlfriend's father is a police officer. So they contact the kid. They take the coin in. They have a look at it. And significantly, it goes to an FBI officer called Robert J. Lamphere, Bob Lamphere, who is, I think, Jim Donovan, we're going to come to him later, is the great hero of the Cold War, the great Western hero of the Cold War. Lamphere is up there as well. And if Tom Hanks gets a chance to play someone else at some point in the future, Bob Lamphere's the guy. Lamphere looks at it. He'd been very much involved in anti-Nazi intelligence during the Second World War. And he takes Oswald. And there's various various things that come to him in Lanfear's own book and a wee bit in mine. He goes to it and he works out that there is a Soviet illegal spy in New York. The FBI cannot give him the resources in staff and money that he needs. So it's left for a number of years. But the hollowed out nickel with the microfilm inside, which was Fisher's assistant Hay Hanen's welcome to New York. So he'd obviously slipped it in his pocket and paid it for
right.
something. It had gone into circulation.
Not the best tradecraft in the world.
No. And this is another thing about Hay Hanen. I mean, I hope we're not jumping ahead here.
Please.
But the thing that got Fisher caught, that got Abel caught, was not his name. It was how weak Hay Hanen was. Hay Hanen defected. And you look at his story, he should never have been sent out of the Soviet Union. He was completely hooked. He was a drunk. He couldn't master the languages. So he couldn't speak English. In court, it was the lawyers had a real problem getting him to say anything. And when he said stuff, they couldn't understand him. So he was a guy who should never have been deployed. But you know what happens in organizations, and particularly in the Soviet Union, they've got this situation. Where's the KGB going? Beria's dead. Khrushchev's secret speech of what Stalin had done. You know, what do we do?
Right.
So they don't do anything. They just carry on as if nothing has happened. And they sent this completely hopeless guy to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, you look at that, and you know, most intelligence agencies send their scrubs to Belize or you know somewhere that doesn't have any importance, not necessarily to New York City when that's your arch enemy in the world. But of course, this leads to the arrest and conviction of Fisher / Abel.
Yeah.
And that's where Donovan joins the story in many respects. And I think what's interesting is the prediction that Donovan had at the trial, during the sentencing, of why not to sentence Abel to a much harsher term than perhaps he would have had otherwise.
There are a number of things to say here. One is, and I didn't know this until this particular visit to the United States, that Abel himself asked for legal assistance from the New York Bar Association. It happened in court. They didn't know what to do about her. They didn't have a public defender in that. And he said, Abel said, well, could you approach the New York Bar Association? And New York Bar Association nominated Jim Donovan. So that's how that came about. And this is where I'd say the Spielberg film Bridge of Spies, the depiction by Tom Hanks of Jim Donovan is quite superb. And it begins, because Donovan wasn't a criminal lawyer, he wasn't an intelligence lawyer, he wasn't a constitutional lawyer, he was an insurance lawyer.
Right.
And the film begins with him arguing his client's case on a road traffic accident and who was responsible. And he's clear, calm about the language. And then at the end, when he's arguing the exchange case, the trade case, you suddenly realize, yeah, this is a lawyer at work. Mm-hmm. So Jim Donovan comes in. Now, the story, the drama, here is a guy who's in a New York court defending a fellow who is clearly a spy.
Right.
What does he do? He uses the United States Constitution and the United States law to defend his client. The arrest was unconstitutional. It actually goes to the Supreme Court. He eventually loses on a majority decision, majority of one. So his legal, his straight, laser clear legal defense of his client is a credit to the United States.
Right.
It really is. But then Abel could face the death penalty. And Donovan argues a great deal against that, almost as an afterthought. Donovan says, one day they might capture one of ours,
right,
and we've got someone to trade. And that's so important. Something else I should mention here. Remember that this man Abel, this man Fisher, what is his name, was a British subject.
Right.
What he was doing was spying for a foreign power who was also against the United Kingdom during the Cold War. He was committing treason, which was a capital offence in the United Kingdom.
Right.
Now, if it had been discovered that Fisher was a British national, he could have been extradited. The United States could have washed their hands of it. Hey, he's a Brit. Send him over there. Let them sort it out.
But how would you not? Didn't he have a thick British accent?
Well, I'll come to the accent in a moment, because that is very, very significant. Yeah. But going back to his wife and daughter who were in Moscow, they knew that situation, were absolutely terrified that his Englishness came out. But your question there. And here again, another great, great performance, the English actor Mark Rylance, who plays Abel in the film. He speaks with a slight Scottish accent. Now, one of the things I've been trying to discover, and you may be able to help me on this, I've not been able to find out whether anyone who has got an actual recording of Abel's voice, has the FBI got one, and I can't get it through the Freedom of Information Act? Possibly. I don't know. But we'll have to follow that up.
Right.
And of course, this all happened 50-plus years ago. And you ask people who met him, how did he speak his English? And they can't really describe it. But the people at the time said he got a kind of Scots-Irish accent. And his cover in New York, for people who may not know this, his cover in New York was as a retired photography guy and who was an amateur artist. And he surrounded himself with young artists who I think was trying to turn onto right. the Soviet cause. But he was painting all the time. And who is this guy? Why is he talking about it? And he said he got his particular accent because he'd been brought up by a Scots-Irish aunt in Boston. Hmm. Okay. In the film, they say he's got this British accent, and I think that's an error in the film, because right. if they'd really known and that he'd had a British passport, I mean, it would have turned out very, very, very
right.
differently.
Absolutely.
But interesting. What was his accent like? Rylance in the film uses the sort of art. It sounds almost like Scottish. Now, the Fisher family were, the male side, were politically active in the UK. They had other emigre friends, Russian emigre friends, Leninists, in Scotland. Fisher's father was involved in gun running at the beginning of the 20th century to Russian revolutionaries. So the family knew people who spoke their English in a Scots manner. Mm-hmm. He was brought up in the north of England where the accent is different from mine, which is a standard southern English accent. And also, in Russian, the R, is pronounced rolled rather like it is in Scottish pronunciation of English. So I think that's where his pronunciation comes from.
Yeah, a little bit of an ambiguous accent that no one could place.
Yeah. Actually, I must tell you, so there is a... I spoke to Ed Gamba, one of the arresting officers, and I asked him about that. And he said that, you know, he just got a sounds like a fairly educated English pronunciation. Someone else, I've never been able to track this down, and I think it was a joke that a British writer somewhere, sometime, and part of my work has been to get to the truth. You know, you can never rely on what someone else has said.
Right.
You've got to get to the truth. Now, this British writer said that an FBI officer had said he spoke kind of funny. Now, in the UK, the Geordie accent in the northeast of England is often the butt of jokes. So I think the English writer who wrote that was dwelling on that particular point. But I asked a New York lawyer, in fact, Anthony Palermo, of whom I must tell you more later, who had actually been a prosecution lawyer at the Abel trial. I asked him that. He said, but Vin, all New Yorkers speak kind of funny.
Yeah. That New York might have been the one place that he could have blended in with
Absolutely.
Everybody else. So, moving to the Midwest, he would have stuck out like a sore thumb, but who knows what people's accents are
Absolutely.
In New York. So it is the perfect place. Talk about Abel's artistry. Actually, he became a pretty pretty accomplished artist. I mean, we here at the museum have several of his hand drawings from his jail cell when he was in captivity. And he was a good cover story. If you want to pretend that you're going to be an artist, actually being able to do something about it and not drawing like I draw is a good way of going about it. I want to ask you a little bit about the time that he was in captivity, because he seemed to have established at least a friendly relationship with his jailers, with the warden. And I think that might show a little bit about his personality and in the way that he reacted with those around him. Can you talk a little bit about that? And maybe this works into the story about the prosecutors as well, like where he was somebody that made friends, somebody that was personable.
I think that's absolutely right. The art, I didn't know that the museum had these Fisher pictures. And before I leave the United States, I got to see them. That is significant. There are two things there, Vincent. There's the art and his ability to make friends. This is very interesting. He was born in a part of the northeast of England where the American artist Winslow Homer had lived and painted for a while at the end of the 19th century. Colour Coats, Tynemouth, northeast of England. A number of Winslow Homer's paintings of that area are in, of course, United States art galleries and museums all over the country, but particularly in New York and in Brooklyn. So Fisher could actually go to museums and art galleries and see paintings of where he was brought up. Right. Which is astonishing. Of course, he could never return to that part of England. And he did some spying in London in the 1930s, which was very, very dangerous. We don't know if he was recalled because he'd been recognized by someone. So art was really big in his life. He actually, the Fisher home had some pictures that he'd drawn and painted in England and taken to Moscow as a teenager in the 1920s. Hmm. So he kept it up, and one of the things he said at the end of his life, he was a depressive. He was unhappy about so many things, and one thing was, if you knew what was going to happen in your life, you would take a rope and hang yourself. And he said, rather than go into this spying business, I'd like to have gone into the Academy of Arts. So there was that element to it. So painting was important, and his work, I've shown it to art critics, and they say he's better than a naive artist. He's not a great artist, but he was going places. He was taught to paint in oils when he was in New York. He had never painted in oils right. before. So this is hugely important. And as you were saying, these sketches he did in prison, he did the prison Christmas cards. He did posters, he did drawings for the prisoners' newspapers, all of this sort of stuff. And again, going back to The Bridge of Spies, the Spielberg film, you can see that there is a relationship that develops between Donovan and Abel. That they both regard each other as significant men. There's no friendship there. But they do see...
There's a mutual respect.
That's the term. Yeah. There is a mutual respect. And you see that throughout Fisher's life. I have to tell you, on my research, I visited Moscow on a couple of occasions. And again, the retired KGB guys really wanted to help. And I met with General Vasily Dozhdalov. He had been the control officer of the Portland spy ring in the UK, Gordon Lonsdale, right. Those guys. And I talked a bit, and I said, everything, how would you describe Willie Fisher? And he said, he was a good man, he was an intellectual man, he was respected by his comrades and those he worked with, he was kind, He was admired. And I said, everyone says that. And he said, well, it would be a surprise if I said differently, wouldn't it?
I want to skip ahead a little bit to talk about once both powers and Abel are in custody in the other respective countries, the negotiations that began between the two countries, and in some cases under the guise of being from Rudolf Abel's wife, Mrs. Abel, which was clearly not, or at least it was, the pen was guided very strongly by the intelligence agencies. Can you talk a little bit about how the back and forth, how the negotiations went? Because according to your book and according to history from other places, the minute Powers is shot down, there's conversations about this. And maybe the movie doesn't quite get into that concept. But, you know, this wasn't something that James Donovan saying, hey, why don't we trade the two? That was an instantaneous reaction.
Again, going back to the film, of course, I've been involved in filmmaking. And, again, I pay credit to the master, Steven Spielberg. A complex story has to be told in a couple of hours on film. So some things are squeezed up. So the negotiations are actually squeezed up in the film. It didn't. So look, Fisher Abel goes to jail in 1957. He's not swapped until 1962. Someone goes to prison. He can't be visited by his family, but he can exchange mail with his family. Or can he? Donovan, says to Donovan, he's not getting letters from his family, or and Donovan works on his behalf. And then there begins to be, Mrs. Abel writes, and so the correspondence between husband and wife starts. When Powers is shot down and is in prison, the Powers family immediately remember what's happened at the trial and say, look, is there something we can do here? And then this really does begin to move quickly, because Mrs. Abel, and I'm making the quotes in inverted commas.
The listeners out in podcast world do not see the air quotes that are made around Mrs. Abel, but we all understand what we're talking about here.
Mrs. Abel saying, can we contact the Powerses? And look, isn't this an opportunity? And so on. And so the letters from Mrs. Abel to her husband and to Jim Donovan at this point are clearly written by the KGB. But of course, remember the German context. East Germany, as you know from the Spy Museum, is key in the Cold War.
Right.
Germany is key in the Cold War. And so the fact that there is German language and German blood in this really helps. So the letters are exchanging, and really that's what brings it closer together and faster. So clearly the United States government and the Soviet government are corresponding through second and third and fourth parties, but they are controlling this exchange and bringing the exchange closer
together. In reality, then, when Donovan goes to Germany to make the final preparation, that is the very end of these long negotiations.
Yes.
That is kind of just finishing things off.
Yeah.
I think one thing that's interesting, and you talk about this in your book as well, is Abel's life after he goes back to the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
To a degree, he's used by the KGB as a trainer, but it comes across as he's not particularly happy about how his life has ended up. Now, he's overjoyed that he's reunited with his family finally. It's been almost a decade, 7-8 years. But what they do with him afterwards is not necessarily, he doesn't have satisfaction later in his life, if I'm reading it right. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You're reading it exactly right. I do want people to read my book, Vincent. Hold on.
Secrets I haven't talked about.
There are secrets you haven't talked. And there is one secret I will not give away in answering this question. His life was... Now, you know better than anyone in this museum that... a spy who's been incarcerated in the country where he has been spying for his own government can never really be trusted again. What has he said? So there was that. But the KGB, the Fisher arrest was a mess. It was a complete fiasco, a chaos. It should never have happened. And of course, they lied like mad. He's not one of our... All of that stuff that you know about. As this unrolled, they suddenly realized they'd got a public relations success on their hands. Here was a guy that everyone thought was straight, honest, honorable, And so back in the Soviet Union, they found this as well. And so they sent him around to schools to talk to kids about, you know, the great Soviet Union, ahead in the space race, all of this stuff. They sent him to East Germany, to Hungary, to help train their intelligence officers. But he was back at the Lubyanka. He had a chair. He didn't have his own desk. He didn't really have a job. They called him in if something happened. You know, what might the Americans be thinking about this? Right. What about that? So on. But it was an unhappy time for him. He enjoyed his life at home with his family, but espionage-wise, he was finished. And he was used, and he knew he was being used.
Well, it is a fascinating story, and again, we don't want to give away anything else. But Vin Arthi is the author of the new book, which is based on an earlier book, which is based on decades of research, called Able, The True Story of the Spy They Traded for Gary Powers. Vin, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at the International Spy Museum.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this author debriefing. We'd like to know if you have any questions or comments about it. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. We look forward to you joining us again for another of our author debriefings. And thanks for listening.